Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is an episode of the Weekly Docket where I recap the headlines in true crime for the week. I know it's been a couple weeks since I've done one of these, and I appreciate you guys being so patient and graceful with me when I have to take breaks. If you didn't hear in one of my recent episodes, I do kind of have a lot going on just in my personal life with moving and, you know, preparing our house for that. Obviously, you guys probably know how stressful that can be. I got a message from one of our listeners that said, this is so sweet. It said, "Hey, beautiful lady, I recently discovered your podcast all the way over from South Africa, and I am hooked. Noticed that you haven't posted in a while, just checking in to see if you are okay. Keep up the good show. Much love, Yolanda." And then it said in parentheses, "You're probably going to butcher that," with laughing faces. And you know what? She just gets me. I might have butchered that because that's kind of my MO when it comes to unique names, but I hope that I got it right. Either way, the message really made me smile. So thank you very much for reaching out. Everything is definitely fine. It's just, you know, busy trying to manage all these different things plus children and all of the stuff that goes with that. So I have been keeping up with the Corey Richens trial. Despite everything else going on, I am trying to stay up to date on that. So if you're listening to those updates, I will have another one coming out really soon on days 6, 7, and 8. And then I'm catching up on 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13, I believe. So yeah, there's a lot going on with the Corey Richens trial. I think it's expected to last like 4 or 5 weeks, which is kind of crazy. If you've been following along with that, I'm curious to hear your thoughts if you think that she's going to be found guilty or not. When I really sit and think about it, I could see it going either way, not because I think that she is innocent, and also not because I think that she's 100% guilty. I think that both sides kind of have their work cut out for them, because at the end of the day, the defense is going to lean on the fact that you cannot prove that she put fentanyl in a cup and that he drank out of that cup, because the cups were never collected, never tested. Whereas with the state, you know, there's a lot of phone calls and testimony from other people who can attest to Eric, you know, using gummies every once in a while, or loving his wife, like even his best friend. They just played this conversation between Corey and Eric's best friend after Eric died. And even he was attesting to how much Eric loved Corey and this and that. I mean, it's obviously very convoluted and crazy. If you haven't been following along, you're probably like, "Kelly, what are you talking about?" But anyway, after hearing that phone call and just hearing more and more evidence, it's like, man, I really don't know how this is going to end up. I really, really don't. So anyway, I'm going to keep following along, but let me know if you are following along, if there's anything that you noticed that you feel like was huge for the state or for the defense. I really want to hear your thoughts. If you do, you can go to mamamystery.com, scroll down to that white box, and you can send me a message. However, if you do that, please let me know who you are, if you want me to know who you are. Otherwise, I'll have no way of knowing and or getting back to you. So anyway, without further ado, let's get into the weekly docket. This week's weekly docket covers 6 major true crime cases that are making headlines this week. Let's just dive right into the first one. The first story comes out of Palm Beach County, Florida, and it's one that investigators say took more than a year of digging through evidence before they were finally able to make an arrest. There was a nurse named Renee Perez, 38 years old, and Renee was arrested in March of 2026 and charged with first-degree murder with a deadly weapon and tampering with physical evidence in the death of 35-year-old Linda Campitelli, a fellow nurse and mother of 2. Now, Linda's body had been found on the side of a road in October of 2024, and for months, the case remained unsolved until detectives say a combination of WhatsApp messages, cell phone data, and surveillance footage helped them build the case that ultimately led to Perez. Linda was 35 years old, a registered nurse, a mother of 2. She lived in Palm Beach County and had been working in the medical field pretty locally. Friends and family described her as someone who was devoted to her children and her work within the healthcare system. The man now accused of killing her is Rene Perez, who was also a nurse that had worked with Linda. Investigators say that the two had known each other through work and had been involved in a secret romantic relationship for about 2 years, despite both of them being married to other people. According to investigators, everything came to a head on October 28th of 2024. That evening, Linda left her home telling her husband she was going out to dinner with friends. Instead, detectives say she was meeting up with Perez to celebrate her birthday. Cell phone evidence shows that the two had been messaging each other frequently through WhatsApp, and in one message the day before the meeting, Linda told Renee that she felt a little nervous about the plan. Later that night, deputies in Palm Beach County received calls about an unresponsive woman lying near a vehicle on Lyons Road in Lake Worth. When deputies arrived, they found Linda lying in the road near her Chevy Tahoe, severely injured. She was ultimately pronounced dead at the scene. The medical examiner later determined her death was a homicide caused by blunt force trauma to her head and torso. Investigators also documented extensive injuries consistent with significant force, including trauma to her skull and her ribs. At first, the case had very few answers, but detectives began piecing together a timeline using cell phone data, surveillance camera, and digital messages. So the evidence that is included are, of course, the WhatsApp conversations, the surveillance footage showing Linda's vehicle arriving at a medical office building in Wellington where Renee had previously worked, and evidence that Renee later went to his workplace at Delray Medical Center and threw something away in the trash shortly after the time investigators believe the killing occurred. Investigators also found blood evidence and signs that the crime scene may have been manipulated, which is why Renee now also faces a tampering with evidence charge. After months of investigation and the execution of numerous search warrants, detectives identified Renee Perez as the primary suspect in the case. He was ultimately arrested in Miami in March of 2026, about 17 months after Linda Campitelli was killed. So now Renee Perez is facing first-degree murder with a deadly weapon, as well as tampering with physical evidence charges. He was booked into the Palm Beach County Jail and appeared in court shortly after his arrest. If convicted, prosecutors say he could face life in prison or possibly the death penalty under Florida law. Detectives say Linda Campitelli and Perez were secretly involved for years, even though both of them were married and working in the same healthcare system. They have not publicly identified a specific motive for the killing, but the probable cause affidavit makes it pretty clear that their romantic relationship and the events surrounding the birthday meeting are central to the case. Renee Perez remains in custody as the case moves through the Palm Beach County court system. Prosecutors are continuing to review evidence, including extensive digital records and surveillance footage that investigators say link him to Linda's death. So as the case proceeds, more details about what happened that night and why are expected to emerge in court, and I'll try to keep an eye on this case to see if I can find more details for you. The next case comes out of Hall County, Georgia, and it is one that has left an entire school community grappling with grief, shock, and a lot of really complicated emotions. If you follow me on Facebook, you might be aware of this case. I feel like it's kind of taken social media by storm. A beloved high school teacher named Jason Hughes was killed during what authorities say started as a senior prank. And it's the kind of thing that has been part of high school culture for decades, but in this case, it ended in tragedy. An 18-year-old student, Jaden Ryan Wallace, is now facing first-degree vehicular homicide charges after investigators say that Jason was struck and killed by Jaden's truck while the teens were fleeing this prank scene. And what makes this case especially heartbreaking is that by all accounts, Jason actually knew that the prank was coming and had planned to surprise the students. So the victim in this case is 40-year-old Jason Hughes. He's a math teacher and a golf coach at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia. Friends and colleagues described him as being deeply committed to his students, and he's been known for mentoring young people both in the classroom and through athletics. He was also a husband and a father of two sons, and his wife, Laura, is also a teacher in the same community. Students and staff say that Jason had a reputation for being the kind of teacher who showed up for kids, someone who invested their lives outside of school as much as inside of it. The student who is now facing the most serious charge is 18-year-old Jaden Ryan Wallace, who investigators say was driving the pickup that struck Jason that night. Wallace was actually among five students involved in the prank that night. According to authorities, the other students identified as Elijah Tate Owens, Aiden Hux, Anna Catherine Luck, and Ariana Cruz are facing misdemeanor charges for criminal trespass and littering. Jaden Wallace, however, faces the much more serious charges of first-degree vehicular homicide, reckless driving, criminal trespass, and littering on private property. So the incident happened late at night on March 6th, right outside of Jason's home in Hall County. According to investigators, five students drove to his house to carry out what's commonly known as a toilet papering prank. Now, I know a lot of you guys are probably familiar with like TPing a house, but just in case you live somewhere that is not familiar with what that means, you literally just throw toilet paper, like rolls of toilet paper, into the trees and across the yard. It's like a pretty harmless prank. I mean, obviously it leaves a big mess, but you know, it's relatively harmless. The prank, though, was reportedly part of a school tradition that is tied to prom season, where seniors will sometimes prank other classmates or even teachers. But this particular situation escalated. Investigators say that Jason came outside after noticing the prank, apparently intending to, like, confront or surprise the students. But when I say confront, it's not in an aggressive way. It's part of this grand tradition where the students pull pranks on the teachers, but if the teachers happen to interrupt the prank or catch them in the midst of doing the prank, then the teachers score points. And if the students get away with the prank, then the students score points. So to understand it in that context is important. So when Jason came outside, the teens began trying to leave the area in two separate vehicles. But authorities say that during the chaos of the moment, Jason accidentally slipped. I guess the ground might have been wet. Maybe they had just gotten rain, allegedly. But he slipped and fell into the street just as Jaden's pickup truck was leaving the scene. So the students reportedly stopped and attempted to help Jason. They called for help. He was taken to the hospital, but later died from his injuries. One of the things investigators and school officials have talked about in the days since this incident is something known locally as junior-senior wars. But in recent years, school officials had grown concerned that the pranks were getting more and more aggressive or disruptive. And so they had actually sent out a warning to students earlier that same day, urging them to avoid participating in prank activity because of safety concerns. And then, of course, tragically, just hours later, Jason was killed. The Hall County Sheriff's Office investigated the incident and concluded that Jason's death occurred during the prank attempt. And authorities say that Jaden was the driver of the truck that struck Jason as the students were attempting to leave. Investigators say there is no evidence of the students intending to harm Jason, but Georgia law still allows criminal charges when a death occurs during reckless driving or certain unlawful acts. Under Georgia law, first-degree vehicular homicide can carry a sentence of 3 to 15 years in prison if convicted. But in a surprising and compassionate response, Jason's family has publicly asked the DA, the prosecutors, not to pursue charges against the students. In fact, Jason's widow, Laura Hughes, said that the family believes the incident was a tragic accident and that her husband cared deeply for the students that are involved. She has urged authorities not to ruin the lives of the teenagers involved, saying her husband would not have wanted that outcome. The Hall County District Attorney has acknowledged the family's wishes, saying their perspective will be given great deference when deciding how to proceed. Jaden and his family have also issued a public statement expressing deep remorse and grief. In that statement, they said that Jason had been a mentor and someone who meant the world to Jaden, and they described this situation as a devastating tragedy for everyone involved. Jaden reportedly said he intends to live in a way that honors Jason's memory. The death of Jason has shaken the North Hall High School community, as you can certainly imagine. Students and teachers have described him as a beloved educator, coach, and mentor who played a major role in shaping students' lives. As of right now, a fundraiser created for the Hughes family has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations within days of the tragedy. The case is still under review by the Hall County DA's office, which will determine how to move forward with the charges if they do. As of now, Jaden remains charged with vehicular homicide and related offenses, while the other students face misdemeanor charges tied to the prank itself. I recently saw an article shared by either the New York Post or TMZ. I can't remember which one, but they, posted Jaden's face with, the caption that says, "Teen will get away scot-free with, death or prank that killed teacher," or something to that effect. And my instant reaction was, scot-free? This kid is going to live with this for the rest of his life. He's probably devastated and incredibly regretful. And to put the weight, like that type of weight on a senior in high school, I can't even imagine that. This was a freak accident. None of it was intentional. I'm sure that it will set a precedent going forward, and maybe this tradition ends, or maybe it's just carried out differently. But to say scot-free, I don't think is fair. This kid is probably traumatized for life. Now, our next story comes out of Highland, Utah, where a jury is being asked to decide whether a nurse manipulated and ultimately killed her own friend in a years-long scheme involving a fake cancer diagnosis and a fatal insulin overdose. The woman at the center of the case is Megan Randall Sundwall, a registered nurse who is currently on trial for aggravated murder and obstruction of justice in the death of her friend, Casey Lynn Terry, who was 38 years old. Prosecutors say Sundwall convinced Terry that she was dying of terminal cancer and then helped administer the insulin that ultimately killed her. But Sundwall's attorney argues something very different, that Terry believed she was terminally ill and that the death may have been a suicide rather than a murder. Yeah, because suicides so frequently take place by injecting insulin. But now it's up to a jury to sort through the years of text messages, medical evidence, and the complicated relationship between the two women. The victim in this case was Casey Lynn Terry, a 38-year-old woman from Highland, Utah. Friends and family described her as someone who loved the outdoors, camping, hunting, and spending time with loved ones. She worked helping adults with disabilities and was known for being nurturing and supportive to the people in her life. She did not have children, but according to her obituary, she loved caring for kids and hoped to one day have a family of her own. The defendant is Megan Sundwall, a nurse who had been friends with Terry for years. Investigators say the two women exchanged tens of thousands of text messages over several years, showcasing an extremely close relationship. Prosecutors now argue that Sundwall used that trust to manipulate Terry into believing that she was dying and eventually into taking part in what they say became a fatal plan. Her death occurred in August of 2024. On August 12th, emergency responders were called to Terry's home after she was found unconscious and struggling to breathe. When medical personnel arrived, Sundwall reportedly told them that Terry had terminal cancer and did not want to be resuscitated. But investigators quickly discovered several problems with that story. There was no medical record showing that Terry had cancer. There was no do not resuscitate order. And there was no documentation giving Sundwall legal authority to make medical decisions on Terry's behalf. Terry was transported to the hospital but never recovered. She died 3 days later. An autopsy later revealed something very alarming, which was that Terry's blood sugar had dropped to extremely low levels due to insulin in her system, even though she was not a diabetic. Medical examiners determined she died from a combination of insulin, promethazine, and other drugs. According to investigators, the insulin had to have been administered from outside the body, meaning it was injected. As detectives began reviewing the evidence, they uncovered a massive digital trail. Investigators found more than 28,000 text messages between Sundwall and Terry dating back several years. Those messages, prosecutors say, included discussions about Terry believing she was terminally ill, Sundwall suggesting ways to end her suffering, and conversations about suicide and death. One message reportedly asked Terry if she wanted to take medication so she could be asleep when this is happening. Prosecutors say these messages show a pattern of manipulation that went on for years. Detectives also discovered that after Terry died, Sundwall searched online for information about Terry's life insurance policy, and she deleted more than 900 text messages from her phone. Investigators believe Sundwall thought she would receive about $1.5 million from Terry's life insurance policy after her death. However, it's not clear whether Sundwall was actually the beneficiary. Sundwall was arrested in March of 2025 and charged with first-degree felony aggravated murder and obstruction of justice. Under Utah law, aggravated murder carries some of the most severe penalties possible, including life in prison and potentially the death penalty, though prosecutors have not said whether they plan to pursue capital punishment. Sundwall has pleaded not guilty. Her attorneys say prosecutors have not proven that Terry's death was a murder. Their argument centers on the idea that Terry believed she had terminal cancer and may have chosen to end her own life. In other words, the defense suggests that this could have been a suicide or even an assisted suicide rather than a homicide. The jury will ultimately have to determine whether Sundwall actively caused Terry's death or whether Terry made the decision herself. The trial has now begun in Utah County, where jurors will hear testimony from medical experts, investigators, and people who knew both of the women. The case will likely hinge on the text messages, and then, of course, the medical evidence and the timeline of events leading up to Terry's death. At the heart of the trial is a deeply unsettling question, which is, did a nurse manipulate her friend into believing she was dying and then kill her? Or was this a tragic situation where someone believed they were terminally ill and made a devastating decision? That is what the jury will ultimately decide. Given the fact that she has no terminally ill or, you know, cancer diagnosis in her medical record, I have to wonder where that came from. Did she come up with that, or did her friend convince her that she was terminally ill? Like, I'm obviously missing a lot of context here, but hopefully more details come out as the trial moves through the court system. Before we go on to story number four, we're going to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of today's episodes. But if you want to skip the ads, you can go to patreon.com/mamamystery. And for a small monthly donation, you can skip all the ads and you can also get bonus content and support the show. So we will be Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing: homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day, you can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's time4learning.com.
At Great Wolf Lodge, there's adventure for the whole family. You and your pack can splash away in the indoor water park where it's always 84 degrees. There's a massive wave pool, a lazy river, and tons of water slides for your pack to enjoy together. And the fun doesn't stop there. Get ready to explore and play at adventure-packed attractions from Magi Quest, a live-action game that takes place throughout the lodge to the Northern Lights Arcade. There's also a bunch of great dining options and complimentary daily events like nightly dance parties, all under one roof. And the best part? With 22 lodges across the country, you're always only a short drive away from adventure. So bring your pack together at a lodge near you. Book your stay today at greatwolf.com and strengthen the pack.
right back. This next story comes out of Queensland, Australia, and it's one that investigators say began with a bizarre and alarming scene on the side of the road and ended with a heartbreaking discovery inside a nearby home. Early on the morning of March 12th, police were called after a man was struck by a car while running into traffic. What authorities uncovered in the hours that followed would turn into a suspected domestic homicide investigation involving a mother and her baby daughter. Inside a home in the rural community of Bulleva, south of Brisbane, or Brisbane, however you pronounce it, in Australia, police found 38-year-old Kate Patterson and her 1-year-old daughter, April, dead. Both had injuries consistent with a violent attack. The man who had been struck by the car, 39-year-old Blake Sears, believed to be the child's father, survived but was hospitalized and initially unable to speak with investigators. The victim was Kate Patterson. She was only 38 years old and a school teacher who lived in Bulleva with her family. Friends and neighbors described her as a dedicated educator who had recently returned to work after maternity leave following the birth of her daughter. Patterson's daughter, April, was just 1 year old. Police have not released many details about the baby's injuries, but confirmed that both deaths are being treated as suspicious. The man struck by the car is Blake Sears. He's 39, and authorities say he lived at the home with Patterson and their daughter. At the time of the incident, witnesses reported seeing him running from the house and appearing injured before he entered traffic and was hit by a vehicle. He remains hospitalized under police watch. The timeline investigators have pieced together actually begins around 7:30 a.m. on March 12th. Witnesses reported seeing a man, later identified as Sears, running down the street a short distance from their home. According to witnesses, he appeared injured and covered in blood. He ran into traffic and was struck by a car. Emergency responders arrived and transported him to a hospital. And while police were attempting to determine who the injured man was and where he came from, officers traced his connection back to the nearby residence on Bulleva Road. When investigators went to the home, they made the grim discovery. Inside, Kate and her daughter April were found dead. Police say the woman and child appeared to have suffered injuries consistent with an edged weapon, suggesting they had been stabbed. So authorities believe Sears fled the house after the attack, ran toward the main road, and was struck by a car. And police say that the driver who was driving that car that hit him is not believed to have done anything wrong and is cooperating with the investigation. Because Sears was unconscious after the collision, investigators initially couldn't interview him, but the deaths have shaken the quiet semi-rural community of South Brisbane. Neighbors told reporters they heard screaming earlier that morning, though many didn't initially realize what had happened. Friends and colleagues described Patterson as a warm and devoted teacher who had recently returned to the classroom after spending time at home with her baby. Police had also emphasized there is no ongoing threat to the public, describing the case as an isolated domestic incident. This next case comes out of Queens, New York, and it's one of those investigations that unfolded slowly over months, with detectives discovering pieces of the puzzle in completely different locations before finally making an arrest. A 75-year-old man named Rupchand Simbu has now been charged with murder, obstruction of governmental administration, and multiple counts of tampering with physical evidence after investigators say he killed his 34-year-old wife, Celicia Alley, dismembered her body, and scattered her remains across different parts of the borough. Alley had been missing since July of 2025, and for months, her family feared the worst. But it wasn't until investigators began connecting separate discoveries of human remains that the full scope of the case came into focus. So the victim is Celicia Alley, a 34-year-old originally from Trinidad. According to investigators, Alley met Simbu in 2023 while she was still living in Trinidad. The two developed a long-distance relationship, and by 2024, she moved to Queens and married him, eventually living together in the neighborhood of South Ozone Park. Family members in Trinidad stayed in regular contact with her, and the last time she was known to be alive was during a FaceTime call with a relative on July 13th of 2025. The man now charged with her murder is Rupchand Simbu, who is, again, 75 years old, who lived with Alley in Queens. Police say that on the day that Alley was last seen alive, Simbu reported her missing to authorities, something investigators now believe may have been an attempt to cover his tracks. On September 22nd of 2025, sanitation workers made a disturbing discovery when they found a garbage bag containing human remains near marshland close to JFK Airport in Queens. The remains were later determined to be a torso missing the head, arms, and legs, wrapped with rope and tape. Investigators were able to begin identifying the remains because of distinctive tattoos that were still visible, even though decomposition had begun. At that point, detectives suspected the remains belonged to the missing woman, Salisha Ali, but they still needed more evidence to confirm it. Then the case took another turn months later when on March 5th of 2026, workers conducting roadside cleanup at the Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge noticed a strong odor and discovered additional human remains, including a severed head. Investigators were able to connect those remains to the torso found the previous fall. The findings confirmed their worst suspicions, and forensic analysis played a major role in the case. According to the NYPD, experts determined that Ali's body had been dismembered using sharp instruments, likely including a knife for soft tissue and a saw to cut through her bone. Even after identifying the remains, investigators continued working for months to build enough evidence to make an arrest. And on March 11th, police arrested Rupshan Simbu inside the home where the couple had lived together in Queens. Detectives now believe that he killed Ali sometime around the date that she was last seen in July. However, the exact circumstances of the killing and the motive have not yet been publicly disclosed by investigators. As of now, Simbu has been charged with murder, obstructing governmental administration, and two counts of tampering with physical evidence. Police say the case is still active as they continue examining evidence related to the disposal of Ali's remains. Neighbors in Queens told reporters that the couple appeared fairly normal from the outside. Some recalled them sitting outside together during the summer, listening to music, or having a drink on the porch. Others said that they were shocked when the news of the arrest spread through the neighborhood, particularly given the disturbing details of the investigation. I think it's very interesting that he is 75 and she is 34. That part is sticking out to me because in cases like that, you would expect the, you know, characters and their ages to be swapped. But as I said, there's been no motive or, you know, other context as to what happened or what led up to it. And hopefully as it moves through the court system, we learn more of those details. Now, our last story also takes place in New York, and it's one that federal investigators say could have ended in a mass casualty event if a few key things had gone differently. Two teenagers from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, 18-year-old Amir Balat and 19-year-old Ibrahim Kayumi, are now facing federal terrorism charges after authorities say they tried to detonate homemade explosives during a protest outside of Gracie Mansion, the official residence of the New York City Mayor, Zohran Mamdani, who has just recently been elected. Fortunately, the devices never exploded and no one was injured, but investigators say the bombs were real and potentially deadly. As authorities dug deeper into the case, they discovered something even more concerning, evidence suggesting the teens had considered other potential targets before settling on the protest in Manhattan. One of the suspects is Amir Balat, 18 years old, who investigators say was responsible for throwing at least one of the improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, into the crowd. According to the federal criminal complaint, Amir Balat allegedly expressed admiration for ISIS and told investigators he wanted to carry out an attack even bigger than the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Amir Balat had recently been enrolled in a virtual high school program in Pennsylvania. The second suspect is Ibrahim Kayumi, who is 19 years old, also from Bucks County. Authorities say he helped plan the attack and was involved in transporting explosive materials to New York. Investigators say he later admitted he had been consuming ISIS propaganda online, which allegedly influenced his actions. The attempted attack took place on March 7th during a demonstration outside Gracie Mansion. So that day, two opposing groups had gathered. There was a group of far-right anti-Islam protesters and a group of counter-protesters who were responding to it. Authorities say Balat and Kayumi arrived at the protest with homemade IEDs packed with shrapnel such as screws and bolts, similar to the bombs used in the Boston Marathon bombing. At one point during the demonstration, one device was thrown toward the crowd, another device was dropped nearby, and a third device was later found inside a vehicle associated with the suspects. Fortunately, none of the explosives ever detonated, and police officers quickly took both suspects into custody at the scene. Thankfully, again, no one was injured. After the arrests, investigators from the FBI and NYPD Joint Terrorism Task Force began examining the suspects' phones, their online activity, and their property. Evidence uncovered during the investigation included a storage unit in Pennsylvania containing explosive residue, materials used to construct additional devices, and writings and messages referencing ISIS ideology. Authorities also found a notebook describing potential soft targets, including shopping centers, suggesting that the suspects had been discussing other locations before ultimately traveling to New York. Investigators believe the attack had been planned for at least a week before the suspects drove to Manhattan with the explosives. One key piece of evidence was surveillance video showing Amir Balat purchasing a 20-foot fireworks fuse days before the attack at a store in Pennsylvania. Authorities say the bombs contained TATP, which is an extremely volatile explosive, sometimes referred to by investigators as the mother of Satan. Both suspects are now facing multiple federal terrorism charges, including attempting to provide material support to ISIS, attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, and terrorism-related offenses tied to the explosives. A federal judge has ordered both men held without bail while the case moves forward. They have not yet entered formal pleas, and New York City officials quickly condemned the attempted attack. Mayor Zohran Mamdani said the suspects had come to New York to commit an act of terrorism, but he praised the rapid response of NYPD officers that prevented anyone else from being hurt. Federal officials echoed that sentiment, emphasizing that the devices could have caused serious injuries or deaths if they had been detonated. But the incident also raises concerns among law enforcement about online radicalization, particularly involving young people exposed to extremist propaganda. Both suspects remain in federal custody as the case moves through the court system. That is it for today's episode of the Weekly Docket. One thing I want to clear up really quick is that I keep seeing that the Corey Richens trial is supposed to last anywhere from 4 to 5 weeks. However, I just now got an alert that the state and the defense are resting their cases today, and now we can expect closing arguments on Monday. After that, the case will be handed over to the jury, and I guess we'll see. We might actually have a verdict next week, which is way sooner than I thought it would be. That's only been like, what, 3 weeks. But regardless, there's a lot coming up next week, and you know I'll be here to cover it all. I've gotten most of my like house stuff out of the way, so I think next week we should kind of get back to regularly scheduled programming. But regardless, I thank you for being patient and sticking around. If you are not already, make sure you're following this podcast so that you get updates or notifications when I drop a new episode. There should be like a follow, a subscribe, a plus button, something to that effect. It's totally free to follow the show. And that way you get notified when I drop a new episode. Anyway, without further ado, have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay vigilant, and stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
Yeah.